Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Edge of Sports, the podcast. I'm Dave Zirin. This week we are going back to the basketball butterfly effect series with hoops aficionado Arya Shirazi. Now, basketball butterfly effect, if you haven't heard the other episodes, is where we look at draft decisions and game out how the NBA world as we know it now would have been dramatically altered if a critical decision had gone in the other direction. So far, we looked at the 2003 draft and asked what the world would be like if the Pistons had taken Carmelo Anthony instead of Darko. We have looked at the 1996 draft and asked what if the Charlotte Hornets had held on to Kobe Bryant instead of trading him to the Lakers for the Camel Lights-loving Vlade Divac. And we wondered how history would have been different if in 1984, the Portland Trail Blazers, with the number 2 pick, had resisted the siren song of center Sam Bowie and gone with this boring choice, Michael Jeffrey Jordan. But today, a little more serious today, because we are looking at one of the most talented and star-crossed drafts in history, 1986. Now, that's known as the Len Bias draft for many, the year when the unbelievably talented Maryland power forward died less than 2 days after being selected second overall by the defending champs, the Boston Celtics. His death, of course, was ruled an overdose that resulted from cocaine. Now, but it's not just about Len Bias. Drugs and the punitive war on drugs, aka suspensions, really just destroyed the careers of a generationally incredible crew of big men from that draft. Chris Washburn, Roy Tarpley, William Bedford. So we are going to talk about this because it's enough to talk about, but just a quick note about the 86 draft. It also was the draft of perhaps the most skilled big man to ever live, Arvydas Sabonis, and he wouldn't see the NBA for another decade, being in the USSR. That was the draft of the beautiful, too beautiful for this world, Drazen Petrovic. And it was also the draft of Steph's dad, Del Curry, and the late, great Kevin Duckworth, the incredible Walter Berry, future Hall of Famer Dennis Rodman, and I didn't even mention Rookie of the Year Chuck Connors Person. But this week, we're going to focus on drugs and its physical harm, criminalization, suspensions that warped a generation of NBA players. That was really long, and now I can finally get to Shiraz. First question for you, Shiraz. Len Bias, 1986, the Celtics, rapidly aging front court, even though they were the defending champs. What would bias have meant to those Celtics teams, and anything else you might want to say about Lem Bias?
The first thing I think about with Bias is remembering the Celtics having the number two pick in that draft just a couple of weeks after they had won another NBA championship. Which was not good news because they were my most hated team, of course. Mm-hmm. So to still have that bad taste in my mouth and then realize that they had the number two pick, it's like, how did this happen? It had to be the Clippers. And yes, indeed, going back and checking, it was the Clippers lottery pick, which fell to the Celtics winding up at number two in exchange for Cedric Maxwell.
Wow.
So it just kind of got worse and worse as a Knicks fan at that time. And Bias was kind of considered, in my memory, maybe the top player in college. It was not a scandal that he didn't go one. And actually, in your very thorough and entertaining intro, I don't believe you mentioned the actual number one pick, Brad Daugherty. Mm-hmm. Who I'm sure that we'll talk about through various threads of this conversation. But it is the fates and the kind of sad fates of many of the players in this draft, which give this draft its name and its reputation. But Bias, of course, was the kind of the featured player and really the poster individual of tragedy. You know, it's one thing to have your career cut short by, in this case, substance abuse. As you said, Bias died 2 days after the draft. So it remains something that's crazy. It remains something that is really, tragic, of course. And he's at the top of the what if list. But that's kind of my memory of Bias, is he was kind of the can't miss player in the draft. And there didn't seem to be justice in the fact that the Celtics would be the beneficiaries of that, particularly as their legendary core, which had already produced three rings, was starting to age out, and Bias seemed to be the perfect kind of a dream inheritant of that. So horrible, though. Absolutely horrible.
I mean, one of the things that makes Bias so tantalizing is the combination of size, power forward, and athleticism, which I would argue you wouldn't see in the NBA until Sean Kemp. The degree to which Bias was able to get his whole head over the rim for what he was. The joke at the time, I remember, was because, Michael Jordan was everybody's cup of tea at the moment, coming off that rookie season he had, or two seasons, sorry. And then he just had scored 63 in the playoffs. And with Len Bias, they were saying, what if Michael Jordan was a power forward? Like, it was capturing, like, that kind of imagination that you really do have to go to Sean Kemp, the Rain Man, to get in your head. Because I was very wired into Bias at the time. I, like you, was very upset that he was going to go to the Celtics. And it's so funny because, Brad Daugherty, great player, career cut short by injuries. This is not a knock on Brad. But this is still that mid-80s era where it's, if you're the best big man, you're going number one. And that kind of ends the discussion. So you got a 7-footer, Daugherty, skilled, bam, number one. But Bias was the best player. I mean, Bias was just, the potential was just through the roof. And I think about those Celtics teams because people always remember Bird really just being ground to a nub and lying on his stomach on the sides because, he can't even sit without his back hurting. But McHale as well, like, injured a lot in the late 80s, playing huge minutes, Parrish, never getting any younger, ever. And just, my God, he was on the, I think he was on the team that Kobe would have been on as a rookie when we were looking at those rosters. But yeah.
I would say ageless, but he always looked ancient as well. So that kind of added to the whole, endless longevity for the Chiefs.
Yeah, the saving grace of the, I thought, kind of weird documentary about Bill Walton that just dropped was the Chief got a lot of time with the mic, and you don't usually see that. The chief had some good things to say, but
I haven't seen it, but I am glad to hear that.
Yeah, so I think it makes a big difference to that team, like just extending itself into the late 80s. Reggie Lewis, another horrific tragedy, but like you begin to see what could have taken shape in Boston.
There's a lot of things I want to respond to that you just said. I'll try to remember them. First off is that I agree that Bias was the best player in college and the best player, basketball player, coming out of the draft. I feel as though the right player went number one and the right player went number two. Brad was not just the best big man available. It turned out that Brad, for the bulk of his, as you said, too short career, he only played 8 years, and I think was an all-star in six of those 8 years. Growing up as a Knicks fan in the 80s, early 90s, with Patrick Ewing as the center of the team and kind of the acknowledged best play center in the East, Brad, for the majority of his career, was the number two best center in the East. It really wasn't a question as Moses was aging and was no longer at the top, and Shaq had not yet arrived. And Brad wasn't just putting up all-star numbers. He was kind of the backbone of a super talented Cavaliers team that was a real force for at least half a decade, when never could overcome Detroit and Chicago, but was right in the conversation at that time as one of the strongest teams in the East and a potential championship contender even. So I wouldn't even say that the Cavaliers should have drafted Bias, that they would have had more success in that time had Bias played, obviously lived and played for them. So I don't, I feel as though Cleveland, absolutely picked the right number one pick. And I wish he would have played longer because I really like Brad's game. Second is that in 1986, Larry was not yet the guy with persistent back problems, lying on the back, on his back on the court, and willing himself to play. That was a few years off. So Larry was coming off his third consecutive MVP trophy, sitting out very few games, playing 40 plus minutes a night. As you said, McHale already had the foot issues and was the gimpier of the two at that time. Larry was still kind of an Iron Man. So the prospect of Bias and the 22-year-old Bias playing alongside Bird in that current state and McHale and the rest of the guys just meant that Boston's championship window, and all we had known is Boston having an available championship window, that was likely going to be extended. They had stumbled into the player who could potentially extend that. It's interesting that you think of Sean Kemp or made the Kemp comparisons. The raw athleticism, certainly, even though Bias's athleticism was less raw than Kemp's, because he had what differentiates them from me is that Bias had much better ball skills. He was capable of being an initiator that Kemp never was. Kemp would have those two big dribbles, tuck it in, and then go over everybody. Bias, to me, always reminded me a little more of Dominique Wilkins, which was scary because Neek was one of the top forwards in the league at that time. So, again, having a player that I kind of liken to Wilkins as much as any current player in the league added to that Boston championship core, was scary. You asked what kind of, what could have been. And you mentioned Reggie Lewis, and that is kind of the most interesting, not the most, but another very interesting aspect of it all. In the wake of Bias's tragic passing and never even, close to donning a Celtics uniform, Boston is still at the top of the East that next year. And then, as opposed to drafting at the top of the first round, they draft at the bottom of the first round and take a very unheralded local player out of Northeastern, Reggie Lewis, who, before his tragic demise, of course, which you referenced, Reggie kind of becomes an all-star. And he becomes, at first, complementing that aging but still effective core, and then really being the one, rather than Bias, Bird kind of passes it to Lewis. And Lewis shows that he's more up to it than I think anybody could have imagined. So would Len Bias have been a better player than Reggie Lewis in the NBA? Possibly/probably, but certainly not definitely, because Reggie was really, really good. So it's interesting that we got an unlikely glimpse with Lewis, of what it might have been for a much younger 6'8" player becoming the focal point for that Celtics team.
Well, that would have been the future, though, because like you said, the Celtics were still strong, so there's no reason to think they still wouldn't have taken Lewis. So
yeah, the two of them playing together, sure.
Bias, I mean, and that would have been amazing, because we're asking what if these horrible deaths had not taken place, and it makes you sad. I mean, I should probably point out, I'm like a 5-minute drive from where Bias went to high school, 15-minute drive from UMD. So, I mean, the way people carry that with them is so strong. And that is, I think that's my first, you remember where you were when it happened moment, maybe of my life, was Len Bias died, and you're just like, I'm sorry, what? It just didn't even make any sense. And then it also, with that tragedy, had this ripple effect of David Stern like cracking down on drugs, the banning of Michael Ray Richardson, which is really a screwed up story about somebody who's been now clean for 36 years and could have gone back to the NBA, but was so hurt by how they handled his situation and putting that sort of brand on him. Inexcusable. But it also meant a real crackdown on some of the other players in this draft. William Bedford, was on the he was drafted by a Phoenix team that, there's no other way to put it, was really into cocaine. That Phoenix team, my God, so much cocaine. And then Chris Washburn, who was raised in a situation where his uncle would share crack with him. And so instead of like trying to figure out like rehabilitation, protecting the privacy of the players, like after the horror of Bias's death, it was like, we're going to show the country that we have this no tolerance policy and all of this. And Len Bias is going to be the symbol of that. So some really sad repercussions. And I didn't even mention Roy Tarpley, who might have been the most talented of all those big guys, other than Bias. But the uses of the death of Len Bias after he passed were pretty brutal. In the broader society, too, like Nancy Reagan jumped on this shit, but in the NBA particularly.
I was really looking forward to talking about this draft, having this conversation. As you said in your intro, the three conversations we've had prior have really centered on what are largely considered maybe the top three drafts of all time, or very, very talked about and celebrated drafts, 1984, 1996, and 2003, the players and legacies and championships that came out of those drafts. This draft obviously has a different reputation and is known for different reasons than championships and on-court success. But you know, I mean, like, this draft, as much as any, is so indicative of the time in which it took place. And, you know, even the bias situation, you know, I was 11 years old when this all happened, and hearing about bias and the circumstances under which he died, I remember for me and the people around me, it wasn't, how could this have happened? It was, man, he got unlucky. You know, I mean, because it was, that's what you do. I mean, he went out and he just got drafted, number two. He went out and celebrated in a way that you went out and celebrated. And he got unlucky. He died from it. Mm-hmm. So I mention that only to say that this is what life was. You and I are from New York. In 1986, that's what life is. And kind of the players coming into the NBA at this time are again, you know, products of this time period. And as you and I are as well. And the interesting thing about this draft is it doesn't fit into as tidy a narrative as one would think, really. I mean, to me, there aren't cautionary tales, because again, going back to 1986, it is a time when, I briefly skimmed the first round, the players drafted in the first round. And these were all players who spent 2, 3, mostly 4 years in college. Mm. Except for Sabonis, who you mentioned at the very end of the first round. There were no other players, foreign players drafted in the first round. Later rounds, yes. But, high school players, of course, was a decade off, and nobody came in after their first year. Washburn, I know, spent 2 years at NC State, and he was the rarity. So again, I say that to say that it's almost a reverse narrative. You know, these are, by the time these players were drafted and came into the league, we were very familiar with them because they had we had followed their college careers, which had been 3 or 4 years. So these are not 18-year-olds coming into money and being overwhelmed. These are 22, 23-year-olds coming into money and appearing as though they are overwhelmed. So
I got to back up something you said about 10 minutes ago. I've been rolling it around in my head, really trying to put myself back when I was 12 years old. And you're absolutely right. I mean, New York in 1986, like, going to the park was a daily thing, and seeing crack vials all over the park and needles all over the park in the gutters, whatever, was just a part of it. And we were at the forefront of that, of the crack, whatever you want to call it, and saw how it was something that some people lived and some people died from doing.
And just to back you up on that, Dave, that it was not, they were not separate. Some of the best ballers on the court in the park would be busting ass and then go sit on the bench and smoking crack.
And smoke. Yeah.
So again, it wasn't you're choosing this or this. In many ways, it all blended together as daily life.
Yeah. No, that's right. And a daily life, though, that some people got lucky and some people didn't. And it's so interesting. Like, I met Chris Washburn, a wildly talented player, we have to point out. Someone who got, I think a dozen different schools under NCAA probation throughout his young journey. And but that goes to something you said. Like, I remember being like personally invested in Chris Washburn, because even though he'd only played a couple years at NC State, he'd already had this soap operatic journey through the college ranks, and you were curious what would happen to him in the pros. But I remember talking to him, and he said about how his uncle gave him crack for the first time, and my response was like, "Wow, was he able to get clean? Is he still with us?" And he looked at me funny and he said, "No, still smoking crack." And now he's just an old man who does it. And if you think of Lem Bias doing it, like, as was reported once, and dying, it's just, it's so fucking sad. It makes me think also of the drug war, and when you drive this stuff underground, it's not as safe. And makes me think of fentanyl right now. I mean, it's just a lot of thoughts pinging through my head about people dying unnecessarily because they're choosing as adults to take part in this. It just, it tears at me a little bit. But hey, honest question. Do you remember Roy Tarpley?
Yeah. I mean, I honestly, I do. I love Roy Tarpley, man. I remember him at Michigan. But I really remember him as part of those Mavs teams that I have very, very fond memories of, you know, kind of those emerging Mavericks team, you know, look, you know, there were always teams in the West at that time looking to possibly be a threat to the Showtime Lakers. And Dallas, for, you know, in the aftermath of this draft that we're speaking of, Dallas had a really, really tough team and a really young team. Mark Aguirre, Rolando Blackman, Derek Harper, and Sam Perkins were a very strong and kind of versatile players in their mid-20s. And adding Tarpley seemed like the perfect guy. And
a rebounding machine.
Because this is such a long time ago now, I think a lot of these players and their games relative to how the NBA game was played at the time, a time that I love in the NBA, of course. Some of these players are lost to time. Tarpley did a lot of that to himself by having a far shorter career than he should have. But man, if you remember, Tarp was so good. Tarp was really fucking amazing. And it was his addition to that team that really made Dallas not only a young team capable of giving you a tough series, but possibly the team to emerge as the next great team in the West. And you know, Washburn and Bedford, really, they never really got started. So, and then they had periods of inactivity and would come back and really didn't make much of an impact. So they're really the what ifs. I mean, Tarpley, when he played again, was such an effective big man with a really, really kind of unique game for an almost 7-footer that kind of take having his career taken away and subtracting him from the NBA landscape was a real loss, because we got a glimpse of the kind of player he was and what he could bring.
I'm looking at his stats right now, and it's so sad because the stats are amazing, like 13 boards a game, 12 boards a game, 12 boards a game, but all the seasons except for one are super truncated. Yeah. I mean, he'd average 12 boards a game in 28 minutes. I mean,
it was a beast.
Yeah, he was, as they say, built different. Yeah. And he could have turned them into something, which really, I really wish they'd gotten an honest shot at being, which is that heir apparent team, because I as well love those guys. And then they scattered them to the Eastern Conference. Rolando, absolutely sinfully underused by Pat Riley in the 94 finals when Starks was struggling. I'll never get over that. And of course, Aguirre, critical piece.
Getting his rings.
Yeah, for those rings, even though I think Dantley got hosed. But that's, you know, Adrian Dantley's like a youth ref out here. Like, we go to games and Dantley's a ref.
Did he tell you that he got hosed?
Actually, he told me he was Adrian Dantley. It's like, yeah. Like it's like the old, you know, I hope he was. It's like the old joke, what's the last thing you ever want to hear when giving oral sex to Willie Nelson? I'm not Willie Nelson. All right, you knew that one.
Yeah, I thought it was funny, but I thought it was funny both times.
Oh, great. Yeah. Very kind.
Yeah.
Very kind. Quick thing about William Bedford is that I actually do remember he came back for a song with Detroit, and I remember being like, whoa, he can shoot. Like, had a pretty shot for a 7-footer. Just another, you know, a sad talent that, and I keep going back to this, like, I'm not tutting at William Bedford and being like, you wasted your shot or some shit like that. It's more like how the league approached drugs.
Well, if you don't mind, Dave, could you elaborate a little more on why you kind of point the finger at the league and feel as though they let down some of these players who got involved with drugs early in their careers? I only say that because when you mentioned that a few minutes ago, my memory is that none of these players were suspended right away.
Mm-hmm.
None of them were dismissed from the league.
Yeah,
right away. But I think both Washburn and Bedford had stop and start suspensions for a couple of years. And again, I'm not playing devil's advocate at all. I'm just saying, as far as punitive measures, my memory was that there were phased aspects to this. So, you know, being more knowledgeable on this, what about the league's response? And again, at a very kind of sensitive period where, you know, not only has one of their potentially marquee young players very publicly died of an overdose right after being drafted, but also, as you said, teams and players throughout the league are kind of being branded as drug users or drug squads, even in the case of the Suns. So how did the league kind of let its players down?
Well, you just gave a good part of the answer, which is about the broader climate in society, both the war on drugs stuff, but also the very real shock and after effects of Bias dying. And the league wanting to show that, you know, David Stern has this under control and there will be a punitive, publicly shaming war on drugs inside the NBA. And I raise this because it would be pretty silly of us to think that cocaine use or any kind of narcotic use was only really around from, you know, 77 to 86 or something like that. And then a new generation rose, you know, drinking smoothies. But it was the way the league chose to respond in that period that was, I think, not rooted in how can we reach a handout to people and help them if they want help. And instead looking at more as we need to send a message to the public that we're not going to put up with this. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that that's really been what the league has done in terms of drugs, like reaching out quietly. It's in the CBA that, you know, the first couple of times it's not allowed to be made public, and the third time then it becomes a public suspension. Like they've softened the edges of this dramatically, took out the marijuana stuff, you know, after having it be hardcore in the days of Donyell Marshall. I don't know why I have to focus on him, but I've always associated.
Just because he always looked high.
Yes.
Yeah. I love Danielle.
I did. I do too. And not least of all for that.
Well, I actually think, Dave, that both of what you said is right, actually. And it's, again, both of those things that you're referring to are very much product of being in the middle of the 80s. We're talking about 1986 into the 1987 season and then going into 1988, where two things come to mind. First of all, you know, to use a lazy and overused phrase, in 1986, it was not a woke environment. So Adam Silver, in dealing with anything, is not going to be caught saying the wrong thing. And whenever I hear Silver say anything, it is such a polished, I mean, it is to the word. It is, lest anybody think we are not sensitive and cognizant of a bigger picture. Mm-hmm. You are wrong. Try to find that in my words. And, you know, and that is now kind of the corporate model. We know we are corporate. We know we're a huge multi-billion dollar corporation. We know now that that is not popular. So we are going to acknowledge that, acknowledge that people come first while still, you know, pocketing billions mm-hmm. and millions. I say that to say that in 1986, that kind of messaging was not a priority. We were not at that point. So a response to drug use and drug deaths was not going to be cuddly as it needs to be now. It was going to, you know, be much firmer. Second of all is that right now the NBA is an unimpeachable financial entity. The NBA is a worldwide brand that is, you know, far more popular outside of this country than any other U.S. sport, as well as being really popular in this country. So the NBA of today is almost always operating from a position of strength. And their responses can reflect that. In 1986, we were 7 years into Magic Johnson and Larry Bird being in the NBA, 2 years into Michael Jordan being in the NBA, and not that far off from the NBA having to show its finals games on tape delay, because that's the only airtime that they could afford. So not being in a position of financial strength, not really being in a position of, the NBA had not attained beloved status as far as its brand went. So I say that, I mention that only to remind us of the climate in which they had to respond to things. I don't think I've ever found myself defending David Stern necessarily, and I'm not here, but again, like kind of the second part of what we've been talking about is, again, in the aftermath of bias, and as you said, the, you know, suspension and trials and tribulations, Michael Ray Richardson and a few others, is if a player had tested positive for cocaine, the league had done nothing, and then shortly after that, the player had died, that would have been a much, much worse PR situation for the NBA than operating under the, you know, probably more punitive, less player and human being supportive policies that they did adopt, I agree with you that they probably, that those policies and that attitude at the time unnecessarily shortened or curtailed careers, which shouldn't have been shortened in that way.
You know, what's kind of interesting as I hear you talk is that this conversation has morphed from being the butterfly effect of Len Bias living and more the butterfly effect of how would the league have been different? How would the lives of people like Roy Tarpley have been different if the league had had a different approach after the death of Len Bias, which we see as a given. Because that's really what it's about. Like, you have this crisis. How do you choose to go forward? And, you know, the NBA went in lockstep with a country that in 84 voted for Reagan 49 states to one. You know, that they rode that wave, just like they were riding a different wave during Black Lives Matter and and now they're trying to thread a different kind of needle. So it's
of course,
right.
Of course.
It's
a lot at stake for them.
Corporate allyship is cracker thin.
Then again, the NBA wants its best players on the court.
Yeah.
So the NBA would want Michael Ray Richardson and Roy Tarpley to be on the basketball court. Players who had not, who had not established themselves, Chris Washburn, certainly more expendable, maybe, if it appears that he's going to be more of a media headache than he is on-court asset. But that's another thing. I mean, I think the NBA certainly, did not want to be hasty in showing that they had a sheriff mentality and just booting players left and right. The actual number of players who have been dismissed from the NBA for drug use, I think, is still very short.
Wow. Amen to that. Well, we're running towards the end of our time, but I wanted to know if you had any comments, any last words, any last thoughts about 86, about how the NBA maybe could have been different if it had a less punitive policy around drugs in the wake of Bias's death. Any thoughts about Walter Berry? No, I'm just kidding.
I almost, feel like there's still so much more to talk about. Some involving Walter Berry and some not. To me, it clearly it's a draft of unreached potential. At the time, there were seven lottery picks. The lottery was seven teams, and of those seven, one player passed away from drug use. Two players had their careers almost derailed from the start from drug use. One had all-star potential and had his career shortened because of drug use. One was an all-star whose back injuries forced him to end his career pretty much in his prime. And then you have two others, one of whom was the rookie of the year and had a very solid career, Chuck Person, player picked right behind him, did not have a solid NBA career, Kenny Walker. So again, even those lottery picks are such a fascinating cross-section of NBA careers. And again, players coming into the league at that time that, I would love to, either on air or off, have a part two discussion about the 1986 draft, because there are so many more kind of interesting players who were involved in this draft.
I guess
it's kind of oft said that with all of the troubles that many of the marquee first rounders had, it had an incredibly fruitful second round, to name just three: Dennis Rodman, Mark Price, and Jeff Hornacek. So again, that just goes to drafting is not a science. But
it is interesting how much they got. I think this is a really interesting draft for how much they got wrong relative to some of the players picked in later rounds. Because in these drafts, I always feel like they're more solid, knowing who's good because of the long college careers.
Right. Exactly. They're much more of a known, and productivity on the college level was prized at that time, really.
They really had some whiffs here.
And as we've said, I mean, the interesting thing about Washburn and Bedford is that they are total what ifs, but by no means were they slam dunk all stars.
Right.
We really have no idea, but it's very possible that one of those two would have been a career backup who flamed out, not because of personal lifestyle, but just because of either talent or work ethic. I mean, you know, the little I know about both of those guys, I don't think anybody was raving about their skills as teammates mm-hmm. and as practice players. So that can translate, that kind of, you know, attitudes or habits can't just be attributed to the fact that that you're doing drugs in your off time. Some players and people just don't work hard. So it has always been, as I said, I was very much looking forward to talking about this draft and reliving it in a certain way, because it remains so fascinating. You know, looking at each draft individually, mm-hmm. what do they, you know, what is the legacy it leaves? 1984, of course, is those four Hall of Famers. 1985 is really the Ewing draft. His legacy comes out of that. 1987 is David Robinson. And then you have this draft, which has whose legacy is, you know, really the storylines that we've discussed.
It's too bad because you think of this is like a punctuation point on an era or an exclamation point because of all the drug stuff. But, you know, in a different universe, this draft is seen as the first one where the NBA showed itself as really getting what overseas, specifically Russian, Eastern European talent could look like. Like the recognition in 1986 that, hey, this guy Arvydas Sabonis is better than any big man in the NBA, save maybe Hakeem Olajuwon, and that's an interesting debate for another time. But then also Drazen Petrovic, and like that to me is just should also be the legacy of this draft. Like those two amazing players, Dennis Rodman. You know, this idea of finding this guy and him turning into this Hall of Famer, that should be a legacy of this draft. Kevin Duckworth, you know, a very critical part of these Trailblazers teams, which we've discussed, that went to the finals, not drafted till the 33rd pick. Hornacek, you know, key number three guy on those Jazz teams that went to the finals, picked 46th. I mean, there's some cool shit here, man. You know, some
really serious players came out of this draft for sure.
Del for sure. Curry, man.
Yep.
And someone who, I know is of your mind, Milt Wagner. Now, why
Louisville.
Wagner? Yeah. Father of
DeJuan, of course.
Yeah.
Milt could never really get it going. Never really get it going in the league. And again, I mean, just a footnote to this is that this was one of the very last years that there was more than two rounds in the draft. And I think just as far as mindsets and thought processes of teams when they're approaching also just speaks to a different reality and a different landscape that was soon to shift. You mentioned Drazen. If this was a couple of years later, Drazen wouldn't have been drafted because there wouldn't have been a third round to draft him in.
Mm.
So again, you know, that can go in a lot of different directions, but it just marks it again as so indicative of its time and a time that was soon to change in the NBA and become the norm for a good while. This is kind of a relic of the era that came right before that, and a relic in life that an era in life that I hold quite dear.
Damn, that was like some F. Scott Fitzgerald shit, Ari. That was like the last line of the Hoops version of The Great Gatsby.
Yeah, I've been called the Muslim Gatsby in the past.
A little bit redundant.
Possibly.
No idea. Possibly. Well, Shiraz, thank you so much for joining me here on the Edge of Sports podcast. Thank you to the audience for saying, hey, let's get another basketball butterfly effect. So we're going to have to do this again in el futuro, sir.
Had a great time as always, Dave. I look forward to speaking with you again.
Great stuff. We'll be right back after a quick word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine. We'll be back right after this, but first, a quick word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine. Okay, look, the need for independent journalism has never been more important, and The Nation brings it each and every week like they've been doing since 1865. I'm serious. This is what you gotta read. It's The Nation Magazine. Go to thenation.com/subscribe, and please never forget that when you support The Nation Magazine, you are also supporting the continued existence of this podcast. So please subscribe. Go to www.thenation.com/subscribe. And now, back to the Edge of Sports podcast. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Thank you so much to Arya Shirazi for Basketball Butterfly Effect Part 4. Thank you so much to The Nation Magazine. It's the only place to go for all the news you need to know. For everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. I am out of here. Peace.